Hey, Blenders, on this week's show, we review the Oscars ceremony and Hans Zimmer returns to the program.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, Blenders, and welcome. Welcome to episode number 302 of Real Blend, a podcast that happily exists in a world where Christopher Nolan has an Oscar for Best Director. My name is Sean O'Connell, the managing editor at Cinema Blend, a co-host of the Real Blend podcast. And on this week's show, we are going to react to the Oscars broadcast, and we're wrapping up something that we have self-promoted as Dune Blend with the return of Hans Zimmer to discuss Dune Part 2. And just saying that out loud gave me goosebumps. That's insane. Hans Zimmer's joining the show. Hello, everybody. Welcome to Real Blend. I know it's Friday, and I know you might be over the Oscars, but we have a lot of thoughts, and we kind of figured you guys would want to hear from us regarding them. I'm going to start with Jake Hamilton of Fox 32 in Chicago. Hello, Jacob. How are you, sir?
I'm picturing Kevin McCarthy, who is not with us this week because he had a prior work commitment. But I picture him existing in a post-Nolan Oscar world, just laying on the ground, hugging his two steelbook copies of Oppenheimer. That's where I picture he's at right now.
To tell the truth, Jake, Kevin imploded. Kevin no longer is with us.
He's gone.
Popped like a soap bubble the minute it happened. Yeah, that's exactly and the right. Winner is Christopher Nolan. Kevin glowed and popped.
And just done. But to your point, I'd like to think that our thoughts on the Oscars are worth listening to, if only because our guest today, Mr. Zimmer, referred to us as people who are helping save cinema.
Ooh. It's true, we did. Yes, it's true. That's a great tease. Filling in for Kevin is Gabe Kovach in the producer's chair and co-host chair. Hey, yes. Gabe, how are you?
I'm savior of cinema number 4 on the call sheet, I think. Sean, you know how I know that we're in the best universe within the multiverse?
Tell me.
Because not only does Christopher Nolan have an Oscar, but that trophy was handed to him by Steven Spielberg.
Oh, by Spielberg. God. On the 30th anniversary of the year that Spielberg won his first Oscar for directing a biopic about an important person during World War II.
And not to jump ahead, because we are going to comment about the Oscars in general, but the format of the multiple winners. And maybe they've never done this for directors, but instead of needing 5 directors to come out and honor the category, they just had the one came out. He was like, I'm need. Sufficient.
Could you imagine if they had 10 Best Picture winners come out to do the 10 Best Picture?
It wouldn't have mattered because Pacino would have skipped over all of them.
And yet they were still kind of vamping for time at the end to get people to Abbott Elementary. That was Michelle's one question, because Michelle went to bed early last night, and when she woke up this morning and she said, did you watch Abbott Elementary? No, honey, I went right to bed after the Oscars.
Did you see
a teacher, so she's a huge fan. No, who was on it?
It was Bradley Cooper.
Was he really?
Yep.
Ah, good for him.
I love that they promoted him as, even though he could have been Oscar winner, they promoted him as Oscar nominee because they knew he wasn't going to win.
So he was in more of Abbott Elementary than he was in the Oscars broadcast.
I love 0-12. Now. He's 0-12.
Hey, man.
Listen.
I say that just sounds like he's doing great work, you know?
Look, at the end of the day, he gets to be Bradley Cooper. He's pretty good. Fine.
Yeah. Pretty solid.
As Kimmel joked, he's a winner of the genetic lottery.
Yes, exactly. Right. Exactly.
As for most of the people in the auditorium.
They actually based Limitless on his life.
Hello, if you're watching us on the YouTube channel, thank you very much for joining us. We are gaining subscribers at a frantic pace, and we love it. It means you guys are sharing the show with friends and family members and people who love movies as much as we all love movies and like getting together on a weekly basis to geek out about them, as we are going to today with our friend Hans Zimmer. If you're listening to us in an audio format but want to check out the video feed, we are at youtube.com/RealBlend Podcast. If you're joining us for the first time, hit subscribe, turn on your notifications, and you'll be alerted every time that the show drops, or just listen to us where you get your audio podcast needs met. Have you signed up yet for Real Blend Premium? Guys, I tell you about it every single week. The Real Blend Premium gets you an ad-free version of the show, and it also gets you a newsletter from me. A little additional insight into the film industry from a seasoned veteran like myself.
I just picture every newsletter now is just like a selfie of you just looking
just
into
a missive.
Camera.
We should give you. You don't have like an author photo in the back of your books, do you? I feel like no.
Oh, I do. Yeah, yeah.
You
yeah.
do?
I
okay,
do. Sure.
I need to look at which one you have. That's the pose I want you to have when I open the back.
That would be great. If yeah. someone can, because we've got some Photoshop wizards out there working True. On us. Can I My get God, a pretentious, I a pretentious Real Blend author shot? I'm actually giving it to
and,
you guys
and in
right
the
now.
Spirit of the Real Blend Oppenheimer photo that was created
yes.
of us.
Oh yeah.
How you feeling
can
about
we,
that?
Can we make can we make Sean the balding one this time?
I was going to say the hairline's looking good.
That,
today,
that was everyone's that really reaction you. To that. It bothered everybody because
he's the only one on the show who's won an award for his hair, right?
Gabe, I haven't say. Won an award for my hair. I've won two.
Oh, I'm sorry.
For my hair.
Well,
the minute I opened that photo, I thought, ooh, Jake's going to have a problem with that.
And I tried to chalk it up to like, well, it's a role that won Downey the Oscar, but it didn't help me at all.
All right. Speaking of Oscar winners and people who we adore, I don't know if we said that, but we do adore Hans Zimmer. And Hans Zimmer came on the show once before and was fantastic. Please go back and check out that old episode. I believe it was for the
was
first
it for
Dune?
Dune Part 1?
Yeah, it was for Dune Part 1. Yes,
that's
it was.
When we became show friends.
Show friends.
That's
show
what
friends.
I like to call us.
Yes, he is. And then this time he's upgraded us from show friends
to saviors of cinema.
This will all make sense in context. And so I'm going to stop trying to explain it and just throw it to this week's official interview on behalf of Dune Part 2. It's Hans Zimmer, legendary composer and show friend of the Real Blend Podcast.
Oh, look at the dogs are having a go.
Yeah.
Right. They're saying okay. hello to you as well. They're also fans of right. yours.
Right. Yes. Good. Excellent. Yeah.
They're unofficial co-hosts of
yeah,
ours.
Exactly. Right.
Excellent.
Yeah.
All right. Ask me anything.
Oh, we'd love to hear that. Well, we are going to start you out by just saying welcome back to the Real Blend Podcast. We absolutely Thank loved you. Having you on not too long back. And so we're excited that you are back. I am going to lead us off with this. You know, one of my favorite facts that I feel like a lot of people forget is that John Williams did not write the Imperial March for Star Wars: A New Hope. He wrote it for The Empire Strikes Back. It took a sequel for him to be inspired to write that incredible, iconic piece of music. So I'm sort of curious for you, what did you get in terms of musical inspiration out of this sequel that maybe wasn't necessarily there for part one?
Well, the advantage I had over John Williams, but actually I don't have any advantage over John Williams because John Williams is the superior composer. So let's start there, right? Okay. But the advantage I had functionally over John Williams is I knew the book so well. Mm. So when we finished Dune Part One, I just carried on writing. And at one point, like Denise says it was 6 months or so after the movie opened, he phoned me up and he said, stop writing, stop sending me things. The movie has opened. And I said, no. I know the movie has opened. And we were not greenlit for the second part at that point, you know? So we never knew if we were going to do it. It's just, but I'm pretty persistent. I'm pretty dogged. So I just kept writing. So I wrote what is now the main theme, really the love theme, or I hate calling it the love theme, but It's a love theme. For this movie, which is really the main theme. And then we went on tour all over Europe. And, you know, playing arenas, 20,000 people a night. And I would start it off every night by playing a tune that they didn't recognize and they didn't know. And I would never tell them what it was. And I just had this idea that if we got to do the sequel, it is a sequel, I suppose. It's the continuation of the story, let's call it that. Mm-hmm. It'd be interesting that there would be a whole bunch of people, like hundreds of thousands, I suppose, that might come and see the movie and go, gosh, somehow emotionally, something resonates here that I know.
Mm. Right.
So yes, I had an advantage to Mr. Williams in so far that I knew where the story was going to go. Mm. The other advantage I had over Mr. Williams was that I was obsessed. You know, I just carried on writing. And, you know, the filmmakers I work with and the filmmakers I love working with, you know, like Chris Nolan or Denis Villeneuve, they let me write away from picture. In fact, it's only just now after Denis and I did a lot of press together that I suddenly realized he never let me read the script because I knew the story so well. So he wanted, you know, I was the first person on. You know, he was the first person he talked to about the first movie. And I knew so much from the book, and I remembered the book so well. So he wanted somebody who kept, like, this pure teenage spirit, because we were both teenagers when we read the book, and we were both teenagers when we fell in love with it. And so, but here's the thing, we managed to recapture that teenage spirit, but we managed to execute the work with the experience of having done a load of movies in the meantime and, you know, having grown up and figured out how to not go and make a complete mess of it.
Wow.
Hans, I'm very curious, when you return to a franchise, whether it be The Dark Knight or even coming back to Dune and you're returning to a cinematic world, and you said you kept writing. So what is your relationship to the existing music, in the sense that, like, do you feel obligated at certain points to reference it, or
yes,
you...
yes. There was a moment, I can't even remember when, but I remember there was like a moment where I suddenly went, oh, I better listen to the old one again, the first one again, because I think I'm leaving it too far behind.
Really interesting.
Because what happens with me is, you know, once I've written it, it's like I've written it out of my system, you know, and it's on to new things. So, you know, I mean, if we go back to Dark Knight, I had done all these horrible experiments for the Joker, and there came a day where we had to go and dub it, you know, more than a trailer. We had to dub a prologue, which Chris wanted to put out into the theaters. And I remember Chris actually getting a little bit of cold feet putting this crazy material in. And he liked it. But, you know, I mean, the Joker thing was probably the most uncommercial, brutal, I don't know, dissonant, nasty, fingers down the blackboard type of thing. And, you know, go, but I've done that a few times now. And I think I've mainly done this with Warner Brothers, where I write something for their big summer movie or their big Christmas movie or something, which is completely uncompromising and, and you know, not cuddly and friendly. But, I think that's part of the job. You know, part of the job is to go and commit and be daring. And, you know, and when you work with people like Chris, or if you work with people like Denis Villeneuve. And I don't know if you guys have seen, but lately there has been like this sort of love fest between Denis and Chris.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, where they're interviewing each other, and in fact we went to we went, I was invited to a dinner the other night where Chris was being honored, you know, and I was sitting at the table with Denise. So, you know, the whole gang was there, you know, Michael Caine was there, you know, and I mean, Cillian Murphy, you know, people. And you should not forget that it's been a handful of movies with Chris. It's been a handful of movies with Denis, but with Chris, it's been 20 years. It's been 21 years that we've been working together in one way or the other, you know, and Denis and I mean, we're so, I remember getting a FaceTime call from him, and I thought it was something about the movie, and you know, I start talking about a scene, and he just says, "We're not talking about the movie. We're only talking about friendship today."
Oh, you know, that's wonderful. And,
you know, that's the people you want to work with.
Yeah,
I have to bring this up, Kevin. I'm really sorry. I have to tell this story. We just had Denis on the show, and we brought up the interviews that he'd been doing with Mr. Nolan, and we've had Mr. Nolan on the show a couple of times as well, right, too. And we said, "You're basically friends with Chris at this point." And Denis goes, no, I need to stop you right now. He's like, "We are closely like approaching a friendship," but he was hesitant to like embrace the fact that they're friends, because he still keeps Nolan on this level of this pedestal. And I understand it, but like Kevin had to say to Denis, like, you know, that people think of you that way also. Like, you're also a genius filmmaker that we have so much respect for.
Well, but you see, it could have gone really wrong that I did, you know, that I switched from working on Chris Nolan movies to working with Denis. And one of the first people to really embrace and congratulate me on the first score was Chris, you know? Mm-hmm. So he, you know, at the end of the day, here's the thing. They're both great filmmakers, you know? Right. They're great proponents of film. You know, we made a movie in this Dune Part Two that you have to see on the bigger screen. Otherwise, you are denying yourself an experience. You know, you're denying yourself quite a bit of actual footage. You know, you're denying yourself things you can only see on the. I see that you're wearing an IMAX hoodie. I mean, yes, okay, great. Okay, so
I can
stop talking right now.
Yeah,
you know, because you get it, yeah. And I venture, my guess is the reason you get it is because as much fun it is to watch things on your iPad or on your whatever it is you're watching on your laptop or whatever, there is an experience that you have when the lights go down and you're surrounded by strangers and you all get to share the same dream or a version of the same dream, and it's a big image, and it just, the image sucks you in, and the speakers are maybe a little bit bigger than your headphones, you know, like, or whatever, you know, and I mean, that was, you know, it's like and I understand why Chris and Denis both got very, very angry about it. You know, when on the previous movie, I mean, we were told 15 minutes before they announced it to the world that we were going to go and day and date stream.
Sure.
And nobody asked us. Nobody asked Denis. Nobody asked me. And in a funny way, you need to ask me. If you tell me we're going to go and on streaming, if you tell me we're going to go, if we're going to make a movie that is basically going to go straight to television or straight to streaming or whatever, mm-hmm. great. I can handle that because I'll write it differently. You know, I won't put that much bottom end into things. You know, my drums will sound different. My top end will sound different. It'll be quite a different score. Sure. You know, not only that, the frequency range is going to be different. I know that if you are, you know, like look, the way we're looking at each other right now, I mean, you know, we can take in the image of ourselves in one go. But if you're on a big screen, it takes a while for your eye to wander across the screen. So the rhythms are different. You know, things have to slow down. They have to breathe, or they're allowed to breathe. You know, so film itself. Now I'm going full Nolan, right?
Please,
you know, I'm going full Nolan, or full IMAX. You know, it's like we humans. I think it's one of the great things we can do. We're storytellers. And we can, you know, I remember on Black Hawk Down working with Baba Mal and him explaining that he comes from a line of storytellers that goes back 2,000 years, you know. And even though you can't understand what he's singing about, you know, whatever he's singing about is profound and important and is part of, you know, human culture. And it's part of what got us here, you know. And the same with cinema, you know, making everything small or isolating, using cinema or streaming to isolate us from each other. I'm not sure it's a good idea, you know.
No.
Yeah. I mean, Mr. Zimmer, you're talking to somebody who saw Dunkirk 6 times in 70 millimeter IMAX in different cities across the country and Canada as well. And I've been a part of that 1/4/3 70 millimeter IMAX experience for so long. It's changed the way I view movies. But, you know, you talk about reading the book as a kid and the themes of Dune I find so fascinating. And there's a line in the first film, which is also from Frank Herbert's book, which is the mystery of life isn't a problem to solve, but a reality to experience. And I find that to be a brilliant quote. I think it's a deep thematic part of the Dune story. I was just curious what that quote means to you, how you view your life in terms of it not being a problem to solve, but a reality to experience, but also maybe how you apply that to the way you make music.
Well, I'm going to give you not quite a counter quote, but I remember working on Thin Red Line, you know, with Terry Malick.
One of your best scores, said, one of my favorite scores you ever did. Thank you. Yeah, yeah.
But, you know, Terry was very inspiring. And part of what, you know, I just remember him saying one day, you know, the question is always more interesting than the answer, which is a little bit like, you know, you want to experience life, you know. I'm going to narrow it down to writing film scores, you know, for a moment, and go, yeah, it gets tough. You know, I sit there for 2 weeks knocking my head against the wall and go, I have no idea what to do. But I wouldn't trade it for anything else. I wouldn't trade the experience for anything else. I wouldn't trade the opportunity of... Number one, okay, so this is going to be a lengthy answer. I wouldn't trade the opportunity, number one, of working with the filmmakers I work with. I mean, the editor on Dune, Joe Walker, and I have been, you know, on and off working together since 1988. That's a fair length of time of, you know, honing our style or honing our commitment to how are we going to go and do this, right? The musicians that are the difference between Dune and sort of pretty much any other score I can think of is, number one, it's not an orchestral score out of an obvious reason that I did not want a science fiction movie to have a European classical music sound. You know, yeah. I mean, I just think it. You know, I love John Williams, I love Star Wars, actually I love The Empire Strikes Back most, but I just think that, you know, that wasn't my job. My job wasn't to go and imitate a John Williams score. My job was to go, hang on a second, we are in the future, we are on a totally different planet, let's go and invent instruments. And then the other part, why do I love what I do, is because the musicians on this score, they're all virtuosos. You know, they're Guthrie Govan. You know, you ask any guitarist out there, he's, you know, considered one of the truly the best in the world. Tina Guo, you know, Pedro Eustache, you know, I can go on and on. Laura Kotler, I mean, that voice, you know, to have that courage in the first movie to just like, you know, slice the eyeballs off, you know, with her voice. You know, it's like, you know, it's like really going for it. So every single person who was part of this journey and who is part of this journey, you know, is not only extraordinarily good at what they do, I mean, truly a virtuoso, but fearless in their own way, and at the same time, completely collegial. And I was watching Maestro. You know, you get in that movie, you get to the scene, which is the Bernstein conducting Mahler Second at Ely Cathedral. And it's actually one of my favorite moments in real life. You know, you can go and look it up on YouTube, and Bernstein is just like, I don't know, he transcends, they are transcendent, everything is like happening. And I was going, oh, hang on a second. That's what happens when Denis is in the room and all the musicians are in the room. He is our Leonard Bernstein. He's our conductor, you know? He is that. For instance, that rebel yell, that banshee cry of Loas, it's just at the edge of her ruining her voice forever. But, you know, for Denis, you just want to bring that little bit of extra.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing.
I mean, you guys talked to him. You know, you guys had him. You know, you know that there's a man who is you know, not only incredibly imaginative and incredibly brilliant at his work, but there's a gentle soul in there. There's a huge big heart that
it's in his eyes. It's in his eyes. I mean, yeah.
It's like, you know, he's wonderful. You know?
And yet we were joking that he stopped us to say, he goes, I don't use the term genius that often, but Hans Zimmer is a genius.
Oh, yeah, he would never have said that to me, because very early on in our relationship, because he's so generous, you know, so I play him something and it moves him. And then he needs to talk about it and he needs to compliment me. And I'm going, Denis, we got to move on. You know? It's like, we got a movie to do here. Anyway, I get really embarrassed by compliments. So he said, what should I say? And I'm going, oh, it's simple. You know, it's like I play you a piece of music and you just go, it's shit. Well, it's not shit. And depending on how you say it's not shit, I will know everything about it.
has Nolan ever told you that was shit?
No. I mean, look with Chris. It's quite a different. No, I mean, this great thing about Chris. He writes his own scripts, so does Denis. And with Chris, I love reading Chris's script because I have two ways of working. Like, for instance, with Denis, I didn't read the script because I knew the book so well, and I was more interested with him telling me his story, how he wanted to do it. I want to know what was in his head. Right? With Chris, I love reading the script because I actually love reading his writing. But then when we start working, at the beginning, I'm talking about Chris's movie, Chris's words, Chris's script. And then as we go along, we talk, and it becomes like we're not talking about his movie or my music. We're talking about the movie and the music. Mm-hmm. And it becomes completely impersonal, so we can say anything we want to each other, and compliments are not part of the conversation because they're there like they just hold up, you know, the, you know, they hold up us getting on with things.
The process. Sure. The process.
So the only one I'll give you is this one. Is everybody knows the story of Interstellar, that he wrote a letter to me, and you know, I wrote it from this, from that letter.
I have an Interstellar tattoo right here. It says "Stay," so I'm all in on this. Please tell the story.
Yes. Okay, right. Well, the story is simple. Chris and I were at a party that we didn't want to be at, so we were like in some corner while, you know, Rome was burning or whatever. I have no other idea what the party was. So we're talking movies. Of course we're talking movies.
Of course. Know?
And he looks at me suddenly and he sort of pulls back a little and he goes, would I be up for spending one day just writing whatever came to my mind if he sent me a letter which didn't tell me what the movie was, but just wrote a fable? I said, yeah, great adventure. He actually phoned the director I was working with at that point to ask permission that he could have this day. And, you know, and the letter arrived, and it's this beautiful fable. I'll never really tell anybody what it was. So personal, it was so private, because he knows me so much and he knows my son so well. And it's it's this beautiful fable about what it is to be a father.
Mm.
And so I wrote this fragile little piece. So Sunday, I write this very fragile piece, which is the relationship between my son and me. I phone Chris's house. It's 10 o'clock at night. Emma, his wife, answers. I'm going, hey, listen, I've done it. Do you want me to send it over? She goes, ooh, he's curiously antsy. Can he come down? I'm going, yeah, sure, he can come down. So he comes over. I play him the thing. And he's sitting on the couch. He's sitting behind me on the couch. He's sort of leaning back like this, you know. And I'm going, well, what do you think? And he's going, suppose I better make the movie. So I'm going, well, what is the movie? You know, because there was no clue about what the movie is. And he starts talking about space and starts talking about all that stuff. And I'm going, but tell me, Chris, hang on, how does this fragile little theme relate to big rockets and time and, you know, all the stuff that you had in Interstellar, right? And by the end of the world, for starters, he goes, well, I now know where the heart of the movie is. So it's a compliment. Of course, that's a compliment. But at the same time, it's a very pragmatic way for him. You know, he was struggling with the script, and it gave him... I mean, he's told me he just would put the headphones on and just sit down and write.
Right.
So I'm not saying I had anything to do with writing this wonderful story and this wonderful script, but, you know, part of the composer's job, and I think that part of the composer's job on Dune was as well, you know, inspire your director. Because they sure inspire you, you know. Mm. Or they challenge you, or they whatever it is, you know. It's like that's the fabulousness of the world we live in.
Oh, it is.
Oh. Hey, listen, I wouldn't swap this job for anything else.
Oh, no. We wouldn't want you to.
Yeah. Okay. I'm like getting teary eyed right now, man. I've seen that movie so many times. Jake, take us out. Yeah.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. They focus on exceeding your expectations and simplifying your life. Corient has been helping high achievers just like you enjoy their lives more fully, preserve their wealth, and provide for the people, causes, and communities they care about. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has deeply experienced teams in 23 strategic locations. Corient has extensive knowledge spanning the full spectrum of planning, investing, lending, and money management disciplines. Leverage Corient's exclusive network of experts to craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex they may be. Real wealth requires real solutions. For more information, connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's C-O-R-I-E-N-T.com. Corient.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Mr. Zimmer, this is a big, epic question. It really could spawn your entire career. But there are so many moments of so many of your scores that I love that have that moment that I'm waiting for it to hit in the movie, whether it's in Dark Knight, whether it's Forgive This, they're like, duh, 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 or that, you know, the beautiful voice that you're talking about in the Dune score, or the Wonder Woman theme, the da na 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 na. So I'm sort of curious, those are moments that, you know, as an audience, we're waiting for to hit, but you have to also pick and choose just when you're going to use them, because if you use them too much, then it kind of ruins the effect of it. So I'm sort of curious, when you know you've got gold.
Oh, I've seen Dune 2.
We've all seen it. Seen it.
Yes.
Oh, yeah. Yes.
Seen it twice.
Yeah.
So you know Lua's voice, her banshee cry, mm-hmm. only happens mm-hmm. twice in this one.
Exactly right.
And we were very careful about when we would bring that back, you know? So and a lot of that in this case was discussions with Joe Walker, our editor, who went to music school while I didn't. So I listened to Joe very carefully. With Chris, my first experiences with Mr. Nolan was saying yes to Batman, but saying, I don't know how to do it. I think I need a friend to help me out, because I can be the Dark Knight. I know how to be dark. I know how to do that, but I don't know how to be as elegant as Bruce Wayne is.
And James Newton Howard.
Phone your friend, you know? So James was in London, but Chris is phoning me because he needs a Batman thing. I'm going, but I'm stuck on another movie, and he's going, look, just give me 10 minutes. Just, you know, I'm having a little problem. There's a shot and I can't make it work. I can't, you know, get there, you know. I'm going, so what's the shot? Explain the shot to me. And he goes, well, it's this very tall building and it's night and Batman standing on top of it, looking across Gotham City. I'm going, that's the a shot. That is, if you don't have that shot, you don't have a movie, right? It's not just a trivial conversation. I think there's quite a lot of responsibility that comes with this. And mm-hmm. he explains, you know, how he gets to the shot, etc. So I do write something, and, you know, and then, I don't know, maybe a month later I'm finished with whatever I was working on, I end up in London. I'm looking at the film, and there's that shot, and there's whatever I had just whipped up in a few minutes. Actually, that's not entirely true. I probably took some time over it. and it works, you know, and it's... So that is one of those moments, you know, it's one of those moments, but it's the image and the music combined, and the image and the music support each other, you know, or complete each other, right? So, and I understand, you know, I'll give you another scene. Interstellar, Matthew McConaughey is looking at the videos of his children, right?
Oh, I mean, literally one of the greatest scenes. And that's the first take, right? Of McConaughey's face. It's insane. Sorry.
Okay.
Go ahead.
So Chris is in Iceland. And he phones me up and he goes, well, I have this scene. And this is what happens. And this is the first shot. And this is then there's this shot. And then followed by this shot. And then this. And you see this. And blah, blah, blah. Can you just write something? I'm going, this is too complicated. This is too fragile. This is too complicated. I actually have to see the picture. You got to send me the picture. And he goes, but it's worked really well in the past, the way, you know, we feel time in the same way. We feel, you know, the shape of a scene in the same way. Just give it a go. And if it doesn't work out, I'll send you the footage. So I write the thing, send it to Chris. Couple of days, you know, we're talking about something completely different. And I'm going, oh, how did that thing work out that I sent you? Because, well, we adjusted two frames, but other than that, it was perfect. So it was just knowing each other and him being very articulate, or maybe me just listening carefully. You know, this is one of the things, going back to Dune, which is what we're supposed to be talking about, working with these astonishing musicians. The thing I realize about them is it's not just that they're great players, they're great listeners. Because that's how great music sort of happens, is by listening to each other and supporting each other and getting out of each other's way, and, you know, and then just sort of shoring it all up a little bit. And I love that we didn't do a big orchestral score. I love that it became about individuals. I love that it's uncompromising. I love that it's abrasive, and then at the same time it can be very beautiful. I love that we went out and tortured people building instruments for us, and, you know, isn't ready yet, or, you know, you know, this amazing software writer in Berlin, you know, like, why do you need 5 resonators? Well, because I have this sound in my head and I can't explain it to you. I mean, the opening of Dune, both Dunes, you know, have that crazy voice.
Yes.
I was trying to explain to Denis this idea of a voice, but how to technically do it, because at the end of the day, I'm a failed recording engineer. So I know how to do some of that stuff, but it was impossible to explain it to him. So I said, look, let me just do it. So I made the voice, right? And it never was supposed to open the movie. It was just a way of, you know, the Saduka could sound like this. Da, da, da. You know, and then Denis and Joe came up with the idea that this was a great way to start the movie. Mm. And I'm a big fan of that sort of an idea, because, look, Lion King, you think children's movie, Disney, da, 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 it's going to be, again, it's going to be the orchestra and it's going to be all that. And instead you hear this raw African voice and you instantly know it's not that sort of a Disney movie.
Right. One. Yes.
You know?
Yes.
Sherlock Holmes, I got into trouble momentarily with Warner Brothers because, you know.
Warner Brothers again.
It's a big Christmas movie. And I got out of tune pianos and banjos. And, you know, banjo is about the most, you know, the definition of a gentleman. A gentleman is somebody who knows how to play the banjo but refrains from doing so. So, you know, I got banjos everywhere. And it was loathed for a while by certain executives. Truly loathed. Mm. You know, and then we did a preview and the audience loved it. At which point I got to carry on doing it. And then I just remember opening the script for the second Sherlock Holmes movie, whatever it was called. And the first line was, interior, the gypsy camp. I thought, yes!
Guy Ritchie, man, that's awesome.
Yeah, no, Guy loved what I was doing, you know? I mean, that was the thing. You know, Guy loved it.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's like... Go on.
Oh, I was just going to say, we're running out of time. I wish we had more time.
We have so many questions. We're running out of time with you, man.
Ask me whatever you want.
Well, as we start to wrap you up, I want to ask you, after the first Dune, you said you were obsessed and you just kept writing. Is that the same with post, you know, part two? Are you thinking about Messiah at all, which would be a completely tonally different piece?
Of course I am, and of course I will, and of course... Right now, I can't because I'm in, as you know, as I'm talking to you, I'm in that circle of, you know, still, you know, the afterburner of Dune Part 2, you know, it's like, you know,
and you're touring again soon.
I'm touring again, but that's not just, you know, and I got a couple of other movies on my plate, but that's not just it. It's just like... We are weird. We are weird. You know, Denis and I don't think he will mind me saying this. We were so nervous before the New York premiere. You know, will they like it? Will they, won't they like it? You know, so now everybody's going on about, you know, how much people want to go and see it. You know, and tomorrow's Friday, tomorrow it opens. And I'm going, what if nobody comes? You know, I mean, seriously, I mean, it's like we are. That's how I feel. That's how I feel, right. You know, so right. I can't quite think about the next one because I'm still in the sort of the whirlwind or the maelstrom or the hurricane of, you know, the sandstorm, probably more appropriately.
Very accurate, very on brand. Yeah.
Yes. Mr. Zimmer, I can't not ask you this before you go, because what you did with Josh Brolin, I just love that collaboration and him playing the Balisette and kind of how we're introduced to his character in this new one with the song that he's playing. And I know that he worked with you on that. And I find that to be interesting because as a composer, when you get to work with an actor, I mean, I was just curious what that relationship is like. And did it open you up a little bit more in terms of how you do scores, having an actor work with you?
We've written quite a few songs together.
Yeah.
Because there were quite a few songs in the first one, except they got ditched. And maybe we need to make an album together. Yes. I don't know. He's a delightful writer. Well, he's a good, great poet.
Great poet.
You know, he sees himself as a poet. So
you know this, right, Mr. Zimmer? You know this book, exactly, that he, Greg Fraser.
Actually, you know, he sort of mentions it, but he doesn't quite mention it. I saw the little interview where he mentions about writing with me, you know, and me sending him pictures of icebergs. Well. When he asked me to, when Denis said, can I go and write with him? I was in Antarctica. I was about as opposite to the desert and heat and everything that you can imagine, you know. And I kept sending him pictures of, hey, don't you think the penguins are cute, you know, and stuff like that. you know, and he thought I lost it. And he was probably right, but then it all came together pretty quick. No problem. I mean, it's okay. So you're dealing with people working in 120 degrees in these suits. Sand gets in everywhere. It's the most uncomfortable experience. And the only way they can survive it is by making jokes, being fun, supporting each other, being a family, you know? And that's really how, you know, to answer your question, you know, if Josh would go, hey, let's go and do an album, I'd go, yeah, let's start now, you know? I mean... You know, there are things which go across, you know, yes, yet again, we're talking about time in a Chris Nolan type way. I mean, my career in Hollywood really started off because Barry Levinson gave me a chance on Rain Man. Oh. And now Zendaya, of course, is doing Euphoria with Barry Levinson's son. So there is this generational thing that's going on, and we can talk about... I don't know what, you know, we can talk about why us and why these people and how does all this happen? And, you know, how come we were so lucky? How come we, you know, I mean, I can pinpoint the moment, you know, I can pinpoint the moment that Barry Levinson's wife, Diana, went to see a tiny little movie I did in London and bought him the CD for the soundtrack. And he felt she didn't need to buy him the CD. She could have just said, oh, yeah, I saw a cool movie and quite liked the music. But, you know, she bought him the CD. He was in London. He knocked on my door. So it's all about luck. It's all about timing. You know, there are thousands of great composers out there. On the other hand, when I was working at DreamWorks, and this is probably naughty to say, I was on the same corridor. My office basically was at the same corridor as the other end was John's writing room. And I had taken this job of head of music, which basically because I thought there are thousands of composers who never get a shot and never get listened to. And every tape that was sent to me, not everyone, but most of them, sounded like John Williams. And I kept thinking, why are they sending that? Don't they know that Steven Spielberg can just walk down the corridor and go, hey, John, can you write something? You know, yeah. Why, yeah. You know, so we were definitely the wrong place to send John Williams sound-alike scores to us.
Mr. Zimmer, if you can't tell, we could go on all day talking to you. It is nothing short of an honor. In the spirits of you and Mr. Nolan, I would like to end by asking you this interview, shit or not shit?
Not shit.
Not shit.
Yes, we got fantastic.
No, I love you guys because you love film.
Yeah.
You know, simple as that. You know.
We do. That's the reason we started this show.
No, we started the show to highlight you, highlight people like you in the industry.
No, yeah. Well, maybe, but my answer would be slightly different. I think what you're doing is you're protecting a part of of what makes us human, part of what makes us culturally relevant, part of 20th century storytelling that needs to carry on and needs to get, and is constantly being refined. I mean, you know, it's great, the technology that we have, but, you know, it needs people fighting for it because, hey, it's really the easiest thing in my world and in your world is people saying no. You know, no, they don't want to do this. No, that's too dangerous. That's too risky. You know, I carried on writing after we finished the first part, even though we weren't greenlit on the second part. But I'm a tenacious bastard.
Yeah. We do it because we love it. We don't know what else to do. Okay. I understand where you're coming from in that perspective.
Thank you for being on our show. It's a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on the score and can't wait to get the vinyl.
Thank you.
Okay, we sincerely have to thank our good friends at Warner Brothers who have gone above and beyond to get us the incredible talent that we've had on behalf of their film, Dune Part 2. A film that I personally assume is going to be part of our Oscar conversation next year, right around this time. So book it. But they managed to get us time with Denis Villeneuve, Rebecca Ferguson, Hans Zimmer, and we got Greg Fraser on our own. I'm going to claim that one as ours. But thank you so much for all of the push that they did. Zimmer, I mean, what do you say about him? Honestly, I mean, he's as a composer, he's such a gifted storyteller. He's the kind of guy who I could sit and just listen to him talk for hours at a time. He always strikes me as a guy who's just laid back and in the pocket and ready to entertain at a moment's notice. Like imagine a dinner with him, you know? And it's funny because a lot of times we do get to talk to these composers and they all kind of strike me that way. Daniel Pemberton comes across as a really colorful guy who tells great stories. Michael Giacchino, when we've had him on the show, has been this gregarious dude who's been able to like bust out props from his, you know, his
Ludwig was great too. Yeah.
Ludwig Göransson, who just ended up winning the real. Oh God. Michelle got so tired of me throughout the telecast being like, hey, that's a real blend guest. Real blend guest, Ludwig Göransson. Hey, that's Hoyda Van Hoytema. He was on Real Blend. I was like, enough. Shut up. Yeah. Jakey, what's your takeaway from having Zimmer back on the show?
You know, the crazy thing is, I feel like it's a twofold example. But as we were all preparing questions for Zimmer, you kind of, especially when you interview a legend, you kind of go back on their IMDb filmography to kind of be reminded of everything that he's done over the course of his career. And sometimes you look for, you know, an anniversary year, which is always a good excuse to think of something. And, you know, one of the downsides was that, you know, in addition to obviously wanting to talk about Dune Part Two, there were 30 other credits to his name that I wanted to find some sort of an excuse to bring up, whether, you know, was the anniversary of The Lion King or just wanting to bring up, you know, 10,000 other pieces of music. You know, I always think his score from The Rock is super underrated. But and you just don't have time. You don't have time to get to everything that you want to, which is a testament to his filmography. But one of the cool things I discovered is that he's such a brilliant storyteller that in order to sometimes make the points that he wants to make, he'll call back to some of the iconic scores that he made. And the crazy thing was, a lot of the things that I wanted to ask him about, or that you wanted to ask him about, Sean, or that Kevin did, we didn't get to ask, but he still talked about. Like, I really wanted to ask a Lion King question because that's I'd say it's an underrated score. He won an Oscar for it. So, like, I feel like when you're talking about the great Zimmer scores, people don't often list Lion King necessarily up there. He brought that up by himself. I think of, have you guys seen that meme of the dude playing the piano on the beach and the piano's on fire? Oftentimes the caption is like, for example, here, it would be like, "Hey, Hans, it's just a cartoon about lions. Don't get crazy." and then it's Hans Zimmer, it's him on the, you know, kind of what I picture, you know, whenever I think of him with the Lion King. But, you know, it's so funny. I was just in LA covering Kung Fu Panda 4, which, like, you know, I went in to see it. I enjoyed it. It was fun. But there were a couple of moments where I was like, damn, the score is pretty good. Who did this? And I looked it up, and wouldn't you know, it's our good friend, the Zimster. Like, you know, he even like, he doesn't phone it in, whether it's, you know, Dune Part, you know, one that he's winning an Oscar for, or Kung Fu Panda 4. He's given it his all, you know. It's remarkable, and the fact that we can, I don't know, Gabe, was it you said 45 minutes? The fact that we can go 45 minutes, and it's just sort of, I feel like we barely chipped the tip of the iceberg that's sticking out of the water, not even the rest of it that's hidden below. It's a testament to, you know, it doesn't matter how long we would have had with him. It wouldn't have been enough if we had done a 4-hour long sit down, you know, marathon of an interview. We still would have walked away going, "Ah, I can't believe we didn't bring this up." Or, "Ah, I can't," you know, and all we can do is hope that we have him on again.
We also got, I think, really lucky both times, and that we didn't, you know, it'd be great to sit with him in person. Those always have a different vibe to them. But I think we're lucky not getting him at the junket in person, because both of our interviews with him were on Zoom, but he was like in his studio or somewhere. He was very relaxed. It was very casual. I think both times it was kind of later in the evening for him. And that energy, I think, is good for the way he tells stories, the way he talks about, the way he answers questions for us. It just made it feel very special, where, like, you're 5 minutes in and you're just kind of relaxing with Hans Zimmer, and he's just telling you about, this is how Nolan came to me with the Interstellar pitch. And you're like, keep going.
Going. And it's also, too, just a little sort of behind the scenes. We recorded this interview the day before our 300th episode dropped. So, you know, we were all already kind of, I think, at least I was, sort of in my feelings about the show and getting very reflective. And, you know, anytime we hit those milestones, it's hard not to, you know, take pause and, you know, if only for a moment, give ourselves a little pat on the back. So, you know, the fact that I was already in that mindset that day anyway, coupled with an interview from one of my, you know, favorite composers of all time, in which he wraps up the interview by calling my friends and myself, you know, some of the saviors of cinema, which, look, we joke when we say
it's,
that.
It's, and, us, and by, you know, it's us, and it's Tom Cruise.
That's exactly right.
That's what we always say. That's what we always say.
You know, look, we're not you know, conceited enough to necessarily buy into that, but
it's a very sweet thing to say.
Speak for yourself. It was a very sweet thing to say by a guy who we all admire, and the fact that it was said on a day when we were already feeling very reflective about some of the accomplishments that we made on the show. It coupled for a very sweet moment, a very great afternoon.
It also strikes me, too, how humble he is. I mean, he's Hans Zimmer, for God's sakes. And if you remember the beginning of the interview, you bring up the Empire Strikes Back question. Mm-hmm. And he's like one of the very few people that he could say this about, where he was like, he starts to talk about John Williams and he's like, first off, let's just clear things up. John Williams is such a better composer than I am. And I was like, you're Hans Zimmer. Yeah. What are you talking about?
But he's John Williams.
But it's right. Yeah.
If you were going to make any argument about like who's taking up the John Williams mantle.
Sure.
Hans Zimmer would probably lead that conversation. And look, I would imagine that Zimmer Zimmer probably doesn't want to be the next John Williams. He wants to be the first Hans Zimmer, which, you know, it's fair in its own right. But, when you're talking about the greats, and the reason I consider John Williams, obviously, for so many reasons, to be the great, is that I can go to my mom, who maybe doesn't know who John Williams is, and sing a couple of themes, and she'll know exactly what they know. And I think we're at a point where we're starting to get to where with Zimmer, where you can sort of whistle a few things and know what they are.
I think you're right, though. Like, one is not the next, the other. They are both individual.
Exactly.
Completely untouchable legacies. Yeah,
exactly right.
But it's been exciting to see some of the up-and-comers. And I think our friend Ludwig Göransson is one of those who won an Oscar.
I mean, he's arrived.
Yeah.
For his work in Oppenheimer. So let's use that to transition into the Oscars telecast. So it's a Friday, whenever you're listening to this, but I will clue you in on a little behind the scenes. We are recording this on Monday, the day after the Oscars telecast, and it's very fresh.
And we still want to talk about it, damn it.
And we do, because we kind of think if you're listening to this show, you would like to hear our take on the ceremony. God, we've been talking about it since essentially July. When?
How long until we start talking about the next one?
Dune just came out. Let's talk about it.
Yeah. And I want to start by saying that I completely changed my approach to how I was going to talk about the telecast, because early on, and the guys will tell you in the text thread, I was aggressive and angry. I thought that the telecast got off to a terrible start. I thought the jokes to kick off were mean, and I don't mind mean humor, you know, I'm okay with it, but it felt like specifically I'm gonna stop on how long Jimmy Kimmel lingered on Robert Downey Jr.
Yeah, I hated that, if I'm being honest with you.
It feels like every year there's something like that where it's like it sticks out as a sore thumb, and it's weird to me that there's not like an earlier out. Like, you would think that you would, as you're writing the show, you'd go, this is a bit of an aggressive bit. Any point along this, here's your out.
Yeah.
You know, exactly. Like, when this stops working, here's your out. And maybe that's what the dog bit was, but he just read it. But,
you know, Downey and Kimmel have such a great, I mean, Downey always goes on Kimmel's show. Yeah. Like, they have a great relationship. You know, this is not Joe Coy getting up in front of a bunch of celebrities who he's probably never met before and trying out humor. Like, this is, like, I would probably go as far as saying they're at least professional friends. But, but like, I mean, come on. Like, the dude's been sober for literally decades now, you know,
and the joke has been made.
I'm not saying that Robert Downey Jr. is untouchable. Like, of course, go after the guy, but if you're gonna go after him, can you get it something fresher than his 20-year-old addiction that he's been beyond and rehabbed? It just felt so out of place.
Well, that's how I felt sort of about the and you know, it's so funny, I literally had a moment before the show yesterday where I thought, you know, thank goodness it's Kimmel hosting, because I can't handle another the movies are so long bit, because I do like Kimmel, but I feel like the joke about how long the movies are, I mean, haven't we been doing that for 30 years? Like, at this point, like, that feels like one of the most tired cliche movie host bits you can do. And whenever he launched into Killers of the Flower Moon is so long that by the time the movie starts, you could go to Oklahoma. And I'm like, how often do we have to hear jokes? Yes, the movies are long, but you're also saying that to a room full of people who like great long movies, and also to an audience who has no problem watching 6 hours of a TV miniseries in a row. Like, I'm sorry,
yeah,
like,
it's just weird.
The movies are too long bit is just antiquated.
I was at a viewing party, and someone Someone mentioned, they were like, oh, Oppenheimer getting, you know, nominated for editing. They're like, how's a 3-hour movie, you know, get nominated for editing? And I was like, I'm pretty sure this 3-hour movie is about to win. I was like, because it's great and it's really well edited and it's a story that could have been 12 hours long. It's not about whittling, it's about so much more than that.
I feel like that's a joke people say whenever they don't have an understanding of what editing actually is.
Sure,
the same way like Killers of the Flower Moon got editing and it was a 3.5 hours. Like the length of the film, it goes back to that old Roger Ebert quote, which is no good movie is long enough and no bad movie is short enough. We have watched 90-minute movies that feel 3.5 hours, and I'm sorry, Killers of the Flower Moon felt like a 2-hour movie.
I think too many people think of editing as a technical skill and not a creative storytelling skill, which it very much is. It's rewriting the movie for the third and final time, you know?
Yeah.
And I think it's hard to see that. I think it's hard. One, I don't think there's a lot of open conversation. It's harder to find editors talking about storytelling and filmmakers talking about finding the story with an editor, but there's so much more to, how do you make this flow better? How's the pacing?
Right.
And also like, well, no, we were shaving off frames at a time so that this reaction hit you better, you know, like things that's not just technical.
Gabe, you're an editor and you know this, you know, and I edit my own pieces here at Fox, and by no means am I trying to compare, you know, me putting, you know, a length or a special or a package or something together compared to editing Oppenheimer. But, you know, there's an emotional way that you go, but there really is. So, you know, like during the pandemic, when I spent, you know, 3-4 months working on that Boogeyman horror movie monster piece, there's this almost path that you follow where you get like really good when you're editing, and then you get to the point when you're editing where you go like, I hate my life, why did I even start, this is the worst thing I've ever worked on my entire life, and you just want to deassemble the whole thing, and then you kind of like work on it, you kind of power through that, and you kind of and it's just sort of like it's a really creative and oftentimes emotionally draining, it is not just clipping, it is taking a multiple pieces of clay and forming a sculpture, and halfway through hating the sculpture that you're working on and continuously molding it.
I forget exactly what he says. Scorsese has a quote where he's like, if you're not like sick to your stomach when you're editing your movie, like there's something wrong with you. He has like a more eloquent way of putting it, but he talks about like every time he's made some of the greatest movies in cinema history.
Sure.
And each of those times he's been sick to his stomach and hated it and thought that he was terrible, you know?
Yeah.
So back to Kimmel just for a second. I think the show redeemed itself when, as is the case with the host almost all the time, when they take a backseat to the movies in question. And we've talked a bit this year about how the movies that were being honored were, you know, probably one of the strongest groups that we've seen in many a year. And I think that started to be reflected when people got up and, to me, gave some of the most emotional speeches that I've seen in a really long time. Partly, I'm going to credit that to this format that I just really love, which is previous hosts or previous winners coming out and recognizing the people who are being nominated. I'm gonna jump right to the best actress one. By the time Jessica Lange is you know giving Carrie Mulligan all of this praise, I'm watching Carrie Mulligan and waiting to see when she's gonna crack, because I'm tearing up, you know, and getting all choked up at this praise. And when the person has like a direct relationship, like I think of Sally Field talking to Emma Stone, like Emma Stone sitting there hearing this from someone she must have idolized as a kid growing up. Now, all of those didn't work. You know, there were clearly some people who were put up there who didn't have a strong connection to the people that they were recognizing. But when it worked, I thought it really worked. And I'm going to vote for that format to just stay in place. I think it's tremendous.
But I will say, and I don't dislike it, like it yielded some really great moments. The downside of that is that we don't get clips of the acting. And that's always been one of my pet peeves, is whenever we're telling people how great these performances are, but at no point do we ever show them. Because, look, we've seen Anatomy of a Fall and we've seen Sterling K. Brown in American Fiction. But like, there's a good chance that the average person at home hasn't seen all the acting nominees, if not some of them. And I feel like it'd be beneficial to show, you know, so often, you know, I've always argued the relevancy of award shows is to not to entertain the people who are already you know, sold. But the people who maybe have never heard of Anatomy of a Fall, but then see that really great acting clip and they go, okay, well, I gotta see that. Or like someone go, wait, why? You know, the thing, my girlfriend still has not seen Oppenheimer, but like, you know, it's so funny. She, every time, even though we've watched a couple of award shows together, she always goes, oh yeah, he isn't. Robert Downey Jr. is in Oppenheimer, right? And like, it'd be nice if like, we showed some clips of, you know, but the thing is you can't do both. Like, it, like, you know, the five past winners already extends that segment enough and you can't do that plus show a clip. And it's a have your cake and eat it too. It's a really sweet moment, but I do think it does the movies a disservice by not showing clips of their performances.
Can I ask you guys a question to kind of move on from that? I agree with that. Is the honoring the stunt community with a reel, is that a... hey, is this enough? Or is that a, hey, we're going to add a category?
Yeah, I couldn't tell if it was either a really poorly devised slap in the face or them testing the water. But the thing is, like, what do they need to test the waters for? Like, people have been screaming that they want a stunt category for years. Like, they don't need to create this segment just to then sort of peek behind the curtain and go, okay, how do people respond to that?
What I'm hoping for is that they see that and they want that, and whatever process has to go into making that happen is happening. You know, like, I don't know the bureaucracy behind that. And this was my hope, is this was a, we see you, we agree, this is like a very important thing, and here's what we can do, is we can include it in our telecast to some degree. I'm hoping that means it's coming. I hope that means that the people behind the scenes that are making the show and in the Academy are like, yeah, that's kind of insane. That, I mean, this is a very morbid thing to say, but we had this discussion at the viewing party I was at about why it's not. And it's kind of insane that, like, throughout the history of cinema, but in modern time, you know, the last like 50 years, like, the people that literally give their lives making movies are the stunt people. Like, like, those are the people that risk the most, and that they're not. We talk about how hard acting is, and oh, the water was cold, and you're like, yeah, like, so was the car exploding that you were flying up a cliff in, you know, like. It is just a weird blank spot.
It also gives the Academy and that telecast an opportunity to recognize a lot of these tentpole films that don't get into the conversation that Oscar seems to constantly be courting, you know, some way, somehow. Like, next year, let's say it's Furiosa, you know, and the stunt people for Dune Part Two, and maybe the Fall Guy or something like that, that's up there, you know, one year, whatever, it's the next mission that's out there, and you're putting those titles front and center. I'm not saying it's going to get more people to tune in, but
speaking of testing the waters, I would like to ask, do you guys think that, and I always wonder this, and it never really is the case, but whenever they give a comedian a chance to sort of deliver a little mini monologue before presenting an award, I always sort of wonder, is this like a low key audition to see how people respond to hosting? And I can't help but wonder, like, John Mulaney would do a great job. I mean, he's got history hosting, was it the Spirit Awards? Yeah.
Has he written to the Oscars before?
It wouldn't surprise me. He's written, you know, he wrote for SNL for years, and you know, and that Field of Dreams sketch I thought he did was fantastic.
I figured you love that.
He did a similar bit. He has one of his stand up specials. He did a similar bit about The Fugitive, where he sort of runs. He keeps trying to like deliver a speech, but it keeps going back to like talk about the plot of The Fugitive. I think he would be fantastic, and you know, if Kimmel's at a point where, you know, 4 is enough for him, Mulaney would be an incredible swap out.
You know who else would be a fantastic swap out? Ryan fucking Gosling, because Ryan Gosling can do everything.
Yeah,
there's everything. I mean, someone tweeted it. I wish I could remember who it was. It was the perfect summation. It was a picture of him performing I'm Just Ken, and it said, "When you lose the Oscar, but you win the show." Yeah. You win the show. I mean, he to me was the highlight of embracing that song, you know, and all of its lunacy. But I thought that, and maybe it's just the way that it timed out to this show, the humor throughout the show was weird. Weird in an okay way.
Yeah.
Like, the John Cena bit.
I haven't said this, but like, John Cena loved the show.
What, you didn't love it?
I didn't love it. I didn't love it. I you know, it's so funny. I kind of felt bad because you were texting so many moments last night that brought tears to your eyes. And this show did not hit me the way so many moments involving Everything Everywhere All at Once hit me the year before. Like, really? To me, nothing hit the highs of like a Ke Huy Quan winning Best Supporting Actor or Jamie Lee Curtis or Michelle Yeoh. Like I didn't have, like, there were a couple of moments where I was like, oh, that was a good, you know, I love Davine Joy Randolph's speech. There are a couple of moments where I was like, okay, that's a good, that was a good moment. You know, I thought the John Cena thing was really funny. And it could have been a disaster, but I thought it was handled so well. The I'm Just Ken was really great, but overall I found it to be an incredibly, which sucks considering how much I love the movies that were awarded. I found it to be a very forgettable broadcast.
Interesting. Hmm. See, I think the show is at a point where it can only do so much, right? It's still going to butt up against the fact that the show ultimately is too long, that there's going to be highlights and then dips, you know, throughout the course of it. And I guess I give it credit for having to go through the checklist of items it feels like it has to do. The musical numbers, the In Memoriam, you know, and I'm not saying that any of those need to
the
go.
The genre categories.
But you get to them and you're just like, okay, now it's time for this. Yeah. And so ultimately what pulled me through were the speeches. And I thought that Nolan's speech was really nice.
It was a great speech.
Yeah. I thought that Jonathan Glazer's speech was fantastic. Mm-hmm. I thought Emma Stone's speech was remarkable. I thought her getting so emotional.
Yeah.
I honestly don't believe that she thought she was going to win. I honestly believe that she thought it was Lily Gladstone's
and
Oscar.
Honestly, like, not that these sort of things are important, but like that her dress being broken moment was just so Emma Stone. It was so like just a reminder of like, oh, she's, you know, it's such a like a cliche expression, but like stars, they're just like us. My dress would break in that moment kind of thing. I don't disagree. I think I texted you guys halfway through the show and I was like, I feel like the show just hasn't had, like, honestly, I put together, I did a million segments on my morning show today about, you know, the speeches and the moments. And I had a hard time pulling together some of the, like, I pulled some speeches from like the winners that everyone wanted to. And I pulled John Cena and I pulled the Trump moment, you know, with the review for Trump. And I pulled, you know, obviously I'm Just Ken. But for the most part, I feel like I didn't have a lot to really go like, oh my God, look, as opposed to last year, I feel like I had so many. And also, I think maybe a part of it was not loving Kimmel's opening monologue. And then he didn't really come back with like any great bits. Like, do you remember, and again, this made the show go long, but do you remember like that bit that he did a few years ago when they brought like the tour guide, the tour group and they were taking pictures with little stuff.
The margarita bit with Guillermo actually was better, the tequila bit with
but it just felt so fab. I mean, it was just sort of like, you know, that, you know,
but the fact that it was he was breaking, the people around him were genuinely laughing. Yeah. Like for me, like that was, cause I think it was he sitting next to Coleman Domingo?
Yeah, and getting people's names wrong.
And he was just cracking up. He was like, I like tequila.
Anyone else teased for a heartbeat when the show opened and Kimmel was in Barbie sitting next to her on the bench, that I thought we were going to get an old school Billy Crystal?
I did. I definitely did. I didn't. But like, as a host to like, how much, and I know he's not the only one who's ever done that, but I think it is so associated with Billy Crystal. And as a comedian, like, how do you do that without just thinking I'm just ripping off another comedian? Which is one of the worst things you can do as a comedian, you know, just.
Yeah.
You know.
But that to me is a fun way to honor. Yeah. You know, that's a fun way to honor the movies that are being recognized.
Yeah. Yeah. And that one was so well edited. The whole like, you're so beautiful. I know. I haven't eaten in 3 weeks. Like it was very, very well done.
See, I think he can, in a Billy Crystal-esque kind of way, find the way to find the humor in those moments, you know, if they were to insert him into each of the different movies. But you're right. I guess that there's an element of him copying. Was there any winner? So my winner or lack of winner that made me so angry, and this is part of the reason why I was upset with the show in the beginning, is Spider-Verse losing in best animation. And listen, I understand The Boy and the Heron is Miyazaki, and I understand that many people believe that
if it's going to lose to anybody.
Fine. Yeah. But that fucking movie is, I mean, across, and not just as
but there's another one coming. And that's the first half of the, you know, I think that they're,
I understand the that
Oscars
argument
has that the Oscars has that. To me, it seems they have that sort of bias of like, well, there's another
one.
But
what if the third one doesn't happen? What if it never happens?
I agree with you, but I think that that's, you know, that's the game they play as well.
Are we honoring the movie? You know, are they going to do that to Dune Part 2? Because Denis might do Messiah.
That's,
you know,
my concern. Like, that's my concern.
So did you guys have
a really quick sidebar?
A winner or a loser
Messiah
that you were.
Oh,
well, go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, I'm sure a really interesting article, I think it was like Hollywood Reporter or Variety, that brought concern about Dune Part 3 because it very much made a comparison between, for people who've read Dune Messiah, the Dune Messiah is significantly closer to Godfather Part 3 than it is Return of the King.
Okay, interesting.
And it really sort of made me think like either it's going to be a much different movie than we all think it's going to be, or Denis is just going to have to make some shit up. Because the point that it brings up is that Dune Messiah doesn't really have big action set pieces, and it takes place 12 years after the original, and it's more like Paul is emperor now, and a heavy lies ahead that wears the crown sort of thing. Like it drew some really interesting parallels to Godfather Part 3, and it's like it basically brought up this idea that for people who are expecting a Return of the King, big, huge, it all comes together kind of epic thing. If that's the case, Denis literally going to have to make stuff like Lady Jessica, Rebecca Ferguson is not in Dune Messiah.
She's not in it. Yeah.
So like he's going to have to like create a plot line for her. He might have to just pull some stuff out of thin air and get creative short of creating a disappointing third installment.
I think it'll probably won't be called Dune Messiah. I think it'll probably be called Dune Part 3.
I was wondering I think does he call it Dune Part 3?
I think if that's the route, like if that is true, especially if it's going to have to make a lot of changes. But I feel like it was already on that track, because I think that with Part 1 and Part 2, he was trying to incorporate the goal of Messiah.
Sure.
So like he doesn't need to create the exclamation point.
Right. That's
this
fair.
Is a cautionary tale.
And also too, with Anya Taylor-Joy and, that was always wildly different. Yeah. And how they leave Chani at the end of the movie versus the end of the book, I think. Yeah. You're not right. Sorry, I derailed us. But I just thought that was a really interesting comparison that it drew the line between Godfather Part 3.
While we're on this conversation, he does not end Dune Part 2 in a way that has you saying, well, that could be the end if you want it to be. Like,
no.
To paraphrase, they very clearly are like, this is the beginning of the war.
Yeah, which is basically just the new version of Zendaya basically looking at camera saying this is only the beginning.
I'm curious I'm just curious how it's going to go, because I think a lot of people that don't know, like haven't read the books or anything, and they're all really attached to the idea of these other houses. Like I hear a lot of people talking about like, ooh, who are the famous actors that are going to play the leaders of these other houses? And they're like very like Game of Thrones type expectations. So yeah, I mean, the movie just came out, so I guess, we have plenty of time. I hope he makes something else first.
Yeah, that man needs a break. I mean, dude, even think about it, like even Nolan put movies in between each Batman movie. So like he deserves a
this
break.
One makes sense. Part 1, Part 2, it worked. Whatever they did worked. Yeah. But
And there's supposed to be a time gap between Dune and Dune Messiah. So yeah, it's not a bad thing.
Let Timothy age up a little bit, give him an extra couple years.
Yeah.
So there's nothing wrong with that.
So what do we want to say? 6 years before?
Maybe five.
Sure.
Five.
I think the next movie he makes, he can do in 2 years. You know, it's like if it's something, especially if it's something he already has mostly written.
I'd love a prisoners kind of movie.
Yeah,
exactly.
Or even like a standalone sci-fi Arrival type film.
Yeah.
Denis rom-com. What is Denis rom-com with Josh Brolin. And
I bet it would be a fantastic.
It'd be amazing. Yeah, I'd love to see him try anything. All right, Gabe. So let's get to the results of the Oscar wager. I do know that there were. I'm still not convinced that you. I know you missed.
No, worst I've ever. I missed on production design. I missed on costume. This is the worst I've ever done.
Well, but I think we all missed on a few. So,
Kevin, I think, won some good ones.
In last place. We'll start with last place.
Oh, no.
Confirming his worst performance yet with 13 correct categories is Jake Hamilton.
Yeah.
13? Did you leave some blanks?
I missed effects because I picked the creator instead of Godzilla.
I did too.
I missed sound, which I think was a big one because I put Oppenheimer instead of Zone of Interest.
Oh, I think I did too. So I didn't do much better then.
I missed production design and costume. I missed actress, which Sean, didn't you? I think
Sean's the only one that got actress.
Yeah. I don't think we're weighted.
No.
Maybe we should be.
Sean was just ahead with 14 correct.
Okay. Thank you, Emma Stone.
But taking home, with Emma Stone. Taking home the crown, though, was Kevin with 16 correct. He only missed four.
He can never know.
Yeah, he did. When he got Zone of Interest for sound, I was like,
he got
Zone
of Interest, and he got Godzilla Minus One for special effects.
Yeah, did he really? Mm-hmm. Oh, good for him. That's great. Yeah. All right, good for Kevin.
That was big.
We owe him in and out next time we're all in Los Angeles.
Exactly.
You know, I don't, because I feel like I haven't gotten any of the things that I have won over the last few years. I don't owe y'all shit.
I took you out for barbecue the other night. What are you talking about?
You didn't pay for it.
No, he was there. Yours was way too expensive. Did we tell Gabe this story?
Okay.
I think
we were texting about it. But yes, I mean,
that would have been a good chance for you to buy me a Whataburger.
Ooh, God, why would I do that to you? That's unnecessary. All right, so the Oscars have concluded. Christopher Nolan has his Oscar. Oppenheimer has won. And now we move on to next year's ceremony, of which we assume the Dune Part 2 will be a significant one. As you're heading out the door and wrapping up this week's episode, tell us your favorite Hans Zimmer score. We were joking before the show that I might have gone with Pirates of the Caribbean had I remembered the fact that Hans Zimmer didn't actually write the main theme of Pirates, which most people would whistle in a crowd to get you to recognize it. So go over his filmography. Let us know what you think Hans Zimmer's your favorite. Let's go with favorite score from him. And then we'll weigh in on that in the comments underneath the episode. Thank you guys for tuning in to our recap of the Academy Awards, as well as our second conversation with Hans Zimmer on the show. Go back and find the previous one for Dune Part 1, where we also had Denis come on the show for his very first time. And follow us on social media throughout the week as we chime in on all things movie related. We are at Jake's Takes, at Kevin McCarthy TV, providing he's able to pull himself out of the shock that he's in from Christopher Nolan holding a photograph of Christopher Nolan holding two Oscars. Kevin sent us that photo today. I will let you in on this. And also a wonderful picture of Steven Spielberg photographing an In-N-Out burger with his cell phone.
The best part too is he keeps changing the image of the Real Blend text thread to that. Yeah. And then Sean changes it back to Gabe as Einstein, followed by Kevin changing it back to Nolan. I keep getting notifications on my phone, but just realize that you guys changing the picture back and forth.
Big rift in the text thread.
I am at Sean _ O'Connell. Gabe is at Gabe Kovach, and the show is at Real Blend. We're gonna have to say something now. We're really, here's a note to publicists everywhere. If you want to win an Oscar, put your people on the Real Blend.
Sean, question for you though.
Yes. Yes.
If we had the opportunity.
Okay.
To talk Dune with some more conversations with people who made Dune, do you think we should do it?
I would love to do that, Gabe. And a great opportunity for us to do that potentially would be when the movie eventually makes its way to like a 4K Blu-ray release, right?
Okay.
They're gonna make the sand available.
Let's keep that in mind.
The pretty,
it's just
pretty
gonna be good. Like a glass bowl of sand.
All right. Talk to you guys next week. Dunkirk?
Sure.
Oppenheimer, baby. One last time.
All right, Oppenheimer.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get 16-ounce packs of flavorful Angus 90% lean ground sirloin for $4.99 each with a digital coupon. Then buy two, get two free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.